Welcome to Novelist Spotlight, the podcast where published fiction writers are interviewed to gather their insights and writing lessons so we can use them to make ourselves better and more effective writers. There are just three things I ask of you, if appropriate to you and your experience. Please subscribe, please click on the like button, and please share this program link with any family members, friends, or colleagues who might be interested or benefit from the content. Now, on with our program. In the spotlight is Merrick Hansel, one of my colleagues at the magazine publishing company that I work for, that we work for. He is in charge of our European edition of the magazine. He is in charge of our European edition of the magazine. Merrick, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for inviting me on, Mike.
Merrick has published three different novels. Why don't you give us a quick rundown of each of the novels, Merrick, the titles and just the kind of the essence of what they're about. I know that two of them have a martial arts orientation, which that's another thing we have in common, because I was a martial arts practitioner like you were or are.
Yeah.
back in junior high school, I practiced Washinru karate. And then when I got into my early 30s, I studied Kung Fu at the Top Wong Kung Fu Academy here in California. And I got to tell you that how athletic some of these guys are was just amazing. I mean, it was just a great school.
Yeah.
What is your experience with martial arts before we actually get into how it folds into your novels?
Yeah, a little bit similar to you on the karate side. So I did Shotokan karate as a teenager for a few years. Well, actually, maybe 2 years. And then I did a couple of years at university as well, training Shotokan. And then I had a bit of a break and then I started Taekwondo. So I started the sort of Chang, for people who know Taekwondo, it's kind of the ITF, I suppose, Chang Hon style, which is more associated with North Korea rather than the WTF style, which is more associated with South Korea and the Olympics. And I did that for 7 years or so. And then I left London here in the UK, and then I couldn't find a good Taekwondo school. So I did a bit of Wing Chun Kung Fu, which is made famous by Bruce Lee and the Ip Man movies, for people who know those. And then...
In two of your novels have got martial arts either at the core or influenced by.
Yep.
So obviously, practicing, studying martial arts influenced you. Talk about... why you included them in a couple of your novels, including your first one, which is what, Dojang?
The Dojang, those who practice Korean martial arts will know that the Dojang is just the same as the dojo in Japanese. So it's a training hall, name of a training hall. But I kind of played with a bit of, played with the terminology, and I used it to describe a vigilante group. So the Dojang, two of my novels, the Dojang and Redemption, they're about at the core, it's about a vigilante group who use a sort of a form of Taekwondo. They never call it Taekwondo, but it's kind of alluded to an older form of Taekwondo. It's alluded to in both novels. And the vigilante group train in this Korean martial art, which, as I said, is kind of similar to old style Taekwondo, which incidentally is also very similar to Shotokan karate in many ways. But that's a whole other story. So the Dojang is about a leader of one of the chapters or groups of this wider vigilante group. So it's a vigilante group which originates in Poland. And the protagonist in the first novel, The Dojang, is called Piotr, P-I-O-T-R, which is Polish for Pete or Peter. And he's the leader of a local vigilante group in London, which calls itself the Kwan or the Dojang, which is the reason for the name, the Dojang. And it's about his struggle in trying to keep the vigilante group going. Essentially, they're losing their raison d'etre, if you like. Their reason for existence was to be a vigilante group, but they're gradually moving away from crime fighting and moving into sort of underground fighting, so fighting for money or or just moving into regular sort of mixed martial arts competition, and they're losing their essence, which was just as a vigilante group. And at the same time as he's trying to fight to keep the group together and keep them on their original purpose and focus on their original path, he encounters trouble with some local Polish mafia who are also based in London. So
I see some action scenes here.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's got a kind of struggle, and a struggle, an inner struggle and an outer struggle. And then there's also a bit of mystery involved, because one of the people who's sort of undermining him from within, you don't really know who that is until the sort of final reveal, if you like, towards the end of the novel, in one of the final scenes. So, that's kind of the crux of the story, if you like, without giving too much away. And then Redemptio, which is my most recent novel, is about another Polish guy in the UK, because the UK. For those of you who don't know, Mike, I should probably explain it. When Poland joined the EU, this is back when the UK was in the EU as well. Literally tens of thousands of Poles arrived in the country to find work. At the time, the Polish economy was doing okay, but they could get far higher wages here in the UK. And I think it was Tony Blair, who was the Prime Minister at the time, allowed in, said, our borders are open, please come and work here. Whereas countries like Germany were a bit more reticent. But we had tens of thousands of Poles who came here and worked in the UK, and so they built up a life here. So that's why there's so many Poles in the UK. Just for context, for those who don't know.
Yeah, got it.
So the character in Redemptio, the protagonist, the main character, is a guy called Prez, which is kind of a nickname for him. His real name is Przemek, a Polish name, but he's a criminal, so he steals cars, and he's also involved in a gang who also set up fake accidents. So they stage a car crash and they rip off the insurance company and the other person who they've sort of set the crash up against. So, for example, they'd be in a pulled out of a parking mall, a small road on the side of a shopping mall or something, and just bump into the back of the car, and then they'd claim fake injuries, like whiplash or whatever. And anyway, he's in this kind of criminal group, and he's desperate to leave it, but he doesn't seem to know how to get out of there. He doesn't have any other skills. He's in his 20s. He's never really had an education of any meaningful sort. So he's kind of at this kind of weird crossroads in his life where he wants to go straight. He wants to leave the criminal lifestyle behind, but he doesn't know how to. And he bumps into a lawyer who is also based in, this is based in Leeds, by the way, in the northern England, north of England. He bumps into a lawyer who part of his day-to-day work is solving some of these crimes, insurance scam crimes. It's called Cash for Crash here, or Crash for Cash. And it was up to a few years ago, it was a very very prominent criminal activity here in England. But it's his job to try and defend insurance companies against these claims and try and expose the fraud, expose the criminality. But at the same time, he's the leader of one of these vigilante groups that are based in Leeds. So he's the leader of the vigilante group in Leeds, and he finds out a bit more about Prez and offers him a way out of the criminal lifestyle. But the price that Prez has to pay is he has to become an informant on his fellow gang members. So he feeds information to Prez, who in turn feeds it to the police and to others, and it kind of snowballs from there. And Prez finds himself in a lot of trouble with his own group of friends in his criminal gang, but also with other gangs that they get involved in as well. In particular, a group of Romanian criminals that they sell stolen cars to. So it's a bit
so Prez. Prez is on the path to redemption.
Yeah.
And redemption is the title. Mm. But in what is that
in Latin? Yeah,
in Latin. There we go.
Yeah, It's trying to be a bit pretentious maybe with it, but
it's just, no, not at all. It gives it a little panache.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's quite a few. I think there's maybe a couple of movies and another book called Redemption. So I just wanted to change it slightly. But yeah,
not a bad idea. Yeah. So, you know, then you've got I Must Stay at Home, and I'm reading a few of the notes on that. A city in lockdown, a restless soul walks the streets under cover of darkness in search of meaning. Lonely, depressed, and tired, he finds no solace. This almost sounds like the pandemic lockdown. Mm. Is it, or is this something that was written before? Yep. Or was it written during the pandemic lockdown?
Yeah, it was written during it, actually. So it's a bit of a shorter one. I suppose some people would call it a novella rather than a novel, because it comes in under sort of, I think it comes in under 20,000 words, actually. But yeah, it's... yeah, I wrote it last year, and quite quickly, actually. It usually takes me quite a while to write, but this came quite quickly. And I guess I was just like everybody else, just trying to wrestle with the whole lockdowns and the pandemic and what it means. It's based on a lockdown to do with, you know, COVID-19. But it's a bit slightly ambiguous as to where the character, the main character is located. You can kind of tell it's London, but I didn't want to include just the rules that existed in the UK at the time. I kind of combined some other rules, such as those that I've
read. And it makes it more universal.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So some of those I've read about in Australia or other places where sort of masks were mandated for people to wear outside, which was never the case in the UK. But then it was just, it's him on his own, and he's just struggling with the whole concept of being so lonely. His girlfriend left him prior to the lockdown, and that's had a big effect on him. And he doesn't know what to do with himself, and he lives in a very small sort of apartment, flats. And he just walks the streets because he just has nothing else to do. He doesn't have any work. His job's been... he doesn't have a job at the time. He's paid by the government to subsidize his income, which he's lost. And he just struggles with the memories of his time with his girlfriend. He also has a father who is dying of cancer, which is kind of quite personal to me, as you know, Mike, because my father actually passed away of cancer during last year in August. And he got diagnosed in November 2020, so in the first year of the crisis, so he struggles with that because he doesn't get to see his father either, and doesn't see his father before he dies, which isn't my direct experience. Thankfully, I did get to see my father, but that's another element to it as well.
Interesting.
And it leads to a kind of a bit of a crescendo, but then he finally finds some hope, as I kind of allude to in the blurb and the notes that you read out there, Mike. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you know, you made the decision, as I did, as a lot of people do, to self-publish. So your novels and your novella are self-published. I published one of mine, and I'm about to publish a second. I have three others that I'm holding in abeyance with the idea in mind that maybe I'll end up going the traditional route at some point, if that may come to pass. So, I can certainly share my reasons, but I'm curious, what were your reasons? What were some of the calculations that went into deciding to self-publish? Because you've done it three times now.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I think, with the Dojang, maybe perhaps naively, I kind of, because I had, everybody has their own kind of, way to getting to their first novel, don't they? But I kind of had a few aborted attempts, and the Dojang actually changed in its structure and focus quite considerably in the end. I started writing it in 2011 and didn't really complete it until 2015-16. But I initially sent it out to quite a few agents and some publishing houses that were accepting manuscripts or sort of ideas without the need for an agent, and I got a few responses, but not many, and nothing went any further, and then I kind of d- dived a bit more into the whole agent publisher situation at the moment. I guess I kind of concluded that you have to have something really stand out to grab somebody's attention or either know an agent or go through, a couple of tried and tested avenues to get your manuscript in front of someone to take it seriously. So, for example, being on a well-renowned writer's course, for example, at a university or with an agency, that they do those in the UK. They probably do that in the States as well. But I just felt that...
And then factor in one other element to this is that it could even be a standout novel that we already have something in that particular channel.
Yeah.
And we're not going to produce something. We're not going to use something else here. So, and it may be better than what they've got, but it's kind of like we're committed to this. So we're not even going to look at that because we already have a vigilante novel or a martial arts novel.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think, I mean, maybe I was being naive, I researched it a bit and then, I noticed that some self-published authors, well, quite a few self-published authors had gone down that route initially and then managed to get some, a route into the traditional publishing houses. And I think, there are some self-published novelists who are happy doing that. Being self-published, being an independent author or indie author, as they call themselves, and they have control of their income. But I think a lot of novelists anyway would like to, or aspiring novelists would like to eventually be traditionally published. I think I still sit in that sort of boat, but I just wanted to get my stuff out there and I wanted to see, whether I could get any attention that way. So, I liked my stories and I wanted other people to read them. And if they're in a book format that they can buy or an ebook that they can download, then it kind of gives them a chance to do that. And I've had some, fairly decent, quite encouraging feedback from some people. So hopefully it's worth reading for some people. So that's its own sort of reward. And I would never have been able to do that if I hadn't self-published. So it would just be a manuscript still sitting underneath a desk or in a drawer somewhere. So, or just on a laptop.
and just kind of haunting you like, when am I going to see the light of day?
You know,
my story is very similar to yours in that I had a couple aborted attempts. I wrote myself into a corner on the first couple novels I tried to write. Then by the time I wrote Hardwood, which is a campus-based college basketball novel.
Read it. Yep.
Then, I decided I actually had a couple of people interested in it, but didn't pass muster. They obviously saw some other things they liked better. But it was that sort of thing. The other thing is that it's a sports book, so to speak, but I never intended to write sports novels. This one just came to me and it was kind of crying to be written. I did it, but agent after agent, I don't represent sports books. And it's kind of like, well, it's not really a sports book, but you can't go back to them. I mean, if you have to explain it, you are dead in the water right there because you just can't explain it. You can't do that because the reader, they're just figuring, what are you going to do with the readers?
Yeah.
You're going to try to tell readers who are turning their nose up at it. You're not going to have any access to these people who aren't going to buy it because it's a sports book.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
50% of the agents wouldn't just flat out said, won't touch it. But same thing where it's kind of like you want it to see the light of day. And some time has elapsed since I did that. And now I'm going to go out with the second one this year. And probably eventually everything I've written will go the self-publishing route. But there is, as I think you've indicated, there's nothing like an agent sanctioning it and being able to take it to an editor who sanctions it, who takes it to a team of editors who sanctions it. We want to publish your novel and we're going to take it out to market. And we're going to give you some backing, some marketing. It's probably going to be very little of that unless every once in a while they find some new author that they just think this is the next you name it, William Gaddis Martin Amis or whoever you want to name.
That's right.
And they push it hard.
Yeah.
But that's rare. And then almost nobody really makes money at it. So the self-publishing routes, you don't really make a whole lot, although the potential for making more money is definitely there.
Yeah.
Versus,
I think, I don't think the stigma is there so much either with self-publishing. You know, kind of people would be a bit snuffy about it, or kind of, or you couldn't get someone to, you know, you couldn't get the rubber stamp, the approval that from an agent or a publisher. So you've just gone and just self-published. I think some of that snobbery has maybe dissipated slightly. So it's not
a little bit, yeah.
But I think
it all comes down to like somebody actually reading it and figuring out whether or not it's, you know, yeah, this is quality stuff versus, you know, because anybody can self-publish basically. Yeah. I mean, that's really pretty much a fact.
Yeah.
If you want willing to pay the money, but it doesn't mean that there isn't very quality stuff out there that is self-published.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, that's true. Yeah, I think, and also a couple of genres really sort of dominate self-publishing, don't they? Sort of romance, or they call it romance, but it's really kind of, you know, almost kind of, what's it called? 50
Bondage
Shades.
And sex.
Yeah, yeah, right. That's it. Exactly.
Yeah, E.L. James hit big with
that. That's right.
I mean, it's so poorly written. It's right. So poorly written.
Yeah, I've not read it. But
but it's the concept. Well, you know, when I years ago, my wife and I said, why don't we read to each other each night? And we were kind of like, this we couldn't sustain it, because it was just like, this is just not very well done. But, you know, it sometimes it just, you know, as I said to my wife, it's the strength of the concept is what did it.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's what it is. It's the concept is very strong. It sells itself, and the writing is poor, but it's you know, it's overcome by just people interested in the subject matter.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
So you were not obviously, you mentioned a couple of genres. You mentioned romance. What's the other one that you think is especially big in self-publishing?
Maybe sci-fi or fantasy. Yeah. That kind of stuff.
So let's, you're not a genre, you don't consider yourself a genre writer, right? Or do you?
Not particularly.
Are you crime and punishment, or?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could sort of label it as crime and sort of, because that's the other thing that annoyed me, was kind of, where do you pigeonhole yourself when you're sort of approaching agents and stuff? Like, I was like, well, that's kind of, I kind of like your help with that, which is, but anyway, I mean, I guess urban, I kind of coined a phrase urban noir, which is, I don't know. I don't even know if that's.
Did you, really, you said what? Urban law?
Urban noir. So like noir.
Oh, noir. Yeah. I got it. Okay.
Yeah. But you know, I don't know if that's correct, but yeah, I don't particularly.
Well, you can create your own. Yeah.
I mean, it
create
kind of,
your own genre.
It kind of crosses over.
But being a genre writer, do you not agree that being a genre writer gives you a channel that, I mean, obviously crime novels are big.
Yeah.
They're big.
Yeah.
And, are you, did you go that direction naturally because it's where your proclivities took you?
Yeah,
or
yeah,
it is. Okay. It wasn't that you decided, you know, I want to pick a genre because it maximizes my chances of, number one, getting published, number two, having a built-in audience.
Yeah, no. I think I just kind of naturally gravitated towards sort of that stuff.
It's your interest.
Yeah. I kind of almost wanted sort of the vigilante groups to be kind of like an anti kind of mafia thing. So, you know, I have one of my bugbears is that like organized crime can be quite glamorized on, you know, in the written word and also on the screen. So, and I wanted to kind of glamorize vigilantes, kind of good guys. Vigilantes are good guys, and they have, you know, good intentions at heart, but obviously they're breaking the law because you shouldn't be a vigilante. So it's kind of that kind of gray area that I wanted to explore. And
do you remember the movie Death Wish with Charles Bronson?
I don't know.
He was, I'm just going to interrupt for a second here. He was a guy who, I think it was his daughter, was killed. He was in New York City and he became a vigilante. He would ride the subways at night.
Right.
But he was just one guy. But he would... he would end up killing these criminals who were trying to mug him or somebody else. And the cops said, you know, crime is going down in the city because this guy's out there.
Yeah.
They said, maybe we don't want to catch him.
Yeah.
Maybe we just leave him alone.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, audiences loved it because that retribution is, audiences live for that. You sit through a 2-hour movie sometimes and it's just, you're waiting. You just know that that you're going to get the good feeling of the bad guy getting his comeuppance. So, but you're talking about an organized group. So instead of organized crime, this is organized, illegal, but organized law enforcement. Yeah. And they are the good guys protecting people.
Exactly. Yeah. I guess the most, I guess one influence you could say is Lee Child, who wrote the Jack Reacher novels. He's been prolific with those. And I guess that feeds into what you were saying, Mike. You want to see the bad guy get their comeuppance. And I've seen a few interviews on YouTube or read a few interviews from Lee Child, and he kind of talks about how his stories tap into a very primal need that we have, is kind of just wanting to see the bad guy get his just desserts. So yeah, maybe that was something in the back of my mind as well. But yeah, it was just, I wanted to do something with martial arts. I wanted to do something, play with a bit with the origin of martial arts and how they were used originally for street-to-street combat rather than competition. Because I think that's been largely lost in martial arts, apart from things like maybe Krav Maga, the Israeli self-defense style. But now it's a lot of competition, and actually it's been watered down a lot. So even the guys who were going to competitions in the 80s and 70s, now you see some of them, and when it comes to, you know, a real confrontation or a street situation, they have some of the skills, but they're just not hardened. They're not streetwise and hardened to face a criminal who's intent on sort of killing you, essentially. So you have to have that kind of mentality. And I think the old school martial artists kind of had it because it was kind of drummed into them and the way they trained and what have you. So I kind of wanted to tap into that as well. But
You mentioned Lee Child, obviously fabulously successful. There's, I guess, a series now on Netflix or one of the premium channels. I think movies have been made and so on. Mm-hmm. Who are some of the other novelists who influenced you?
Oh yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, like a lot of novelists, like probably like yourself, Mike, I've quite widely read since being a teenager. So it's kind of gone across the board. But I suppose in terms of writing style, I'm quite influenced by people who have kind of a Hemingway-esque, quite a basic style. So that's something that's influenced
me. So kind of lean, muscular prose.
Yeah, try to sort of lean towards that. I guess that there's a couple of novelists. There's one called Willie Vlutin, who's V-L-A-U-T-I-N from I think he's from Oregon. I've read four or five of his novels, and he's one of my favorite novelists at the moment. He's an American novelist, obviously. And he talks about all his stories are about very downtrodden and poor working class people, very down to earth. But I like his writing style. James Elroy from the crime genre is someone who also influenced me in terms of his
American
style.
Tabloid is just a kick-ass novel. I love that novel. Yeah. It's one of my favorites I've ever read. Again, it's American Tabloid for our listeners by James Elroy is just outstanding.
Yeah, no, yeah, agreed. Yes. Yeah. Very good. Yeah. And then there's older novelists like Graham Greene. Mm-hmm. British novelist. He wrote a couple of my favorite novels, Brighton Rock and The Power and the Glory. Brighton Rock is about actually a criminal who's struggling with his own morals and what he's doing, you know, whether he's doing right or wrong, why he's gone.
I also loved The End of the Affair from Graham Greene. That was again, one of my favorite novels. Terrific.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, one of the things. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and then with Mike, because I have Eastern European roots from Poland, I kind of I quite like some Polish stuff, but also the Russian, some of the Russian novelists who can be quite quirky and strange in their vision. But quite wide, really. Yeah, yeah.
One of the things that's impressive is that I know how busy you are because I have a similar job to yours and you're producing works of fiction. How many days a week do you write? When are you able to work this in? Talk a little bit about how you produce.
Yeah. So, so when I first started properly trying to write fiction, I kind of just tried to fit it in here and there, but then I'd find myself not writing for days on end, and it kind of just dragged out and dragged out. And then you find yourself hard to motivate yourself to sit down and start again, because you kind of lose the thread of the story as well and the feel for it. So I've kind of tried to, I kind of have an aim to try and write 2,000 words a day now, actually, but I don't always get around to doing that, but I do, but it does make me write something. Even if it's
morning or evening,
sometimes in the morning, sometimes in the evenings. So I don't watch much.
That's a big commitment, 2,000 words. You know, you hear about some of the famous writers, historic writers. I think Graham Greene was one of them who, when he was getting started, he was writing X number of pages or words a day.
Yeah. I think
so. There is something to that. It's not for everybody, but if you can produce two. You know, if you can hit that mark.
Yeah.
You're familiar with the National Novel Writing. It's a National Novel Writing Month, and you're supposed to produce a novel that's about, 50,000 words?
Yes.
It comes out to 1,700 words a day.
Yes.
So you have to produce quickly, and you're talking 2,000. So actually, you would hit the mark.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people who do that. They don't hit the mark necessarily, but it's a great exercise.
Yes.
Them.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes I hit the mark, sometimes I don't, sometimes you end up scrapping lots of it, but I think it's good to develop the discipline. Like you say, you know, it kind of, even if you only write 400 words, say, at least you've done something that day. So it keeps the momentum going. And sometimes when it's really hard, you know, I mean, people have talked about writer's block for time, you know, since people were writing. But it's not that I don't believe in writer's block. I just think sometimes you just haven't got any ideas, or things just aren't quite working, so you're struggling. But if you're sat at your desk and you're still typing, you're still trying to do something, then it kind of helps you go through that. I think writer's block can sometimes be an excuse for procrastination. So.
I tell you, I've never had writer's block. I mean, it's always been, ideas come pretty easily to me. Knock on wood. But I was just doing a little calculation here. So at 2,000 words a day, you would produce, now granted, you're not doing 2,000 words that are finished product that you're going to necessarily keep.
Yeah.
But you're talking about in a matter of just 50 days at 2,000 words a day, that's a 100,000 word novel.
Yeah.
So my point being, not that you'd be done in 50 days, but that when you're producing that kind of volume and then you start to, you know, mine it, just distill it down, you keep all the good stuff and throw out the bad stuff. You can still produce your finished writing quickly is the whole idea.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I mean, one of my goals is to become more prolific. I mean, I've 2016 was when I published a dojo, and it took me a long time to do that because I was playing around with it and leaving it for ages. And then Redemptio.
I know that feeling.
Yeah. Redemptio took, 2 or 3 years, and I just thought, this is ridiculous. You know, I need to try and become more prolific. So I kind of set myself this 2,000 word goal, and it's kind of worked. It works well with, I must say.
Do you actually average 2,000?
I
know you don't hit the mark every day, but do you? And I mean, maybe some days you hit 3,000. So if you averaged it out, how many words a day would you say if you were to average it out?
Maybe 1,000.
You shoot for 2,000, you end up with
probably 1,000. Yeah, shall we say?
Yeah, still.
Yeah,
that's a 100,000 word novel in 100 days.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. I mean,
so what's a good writing day for you?
Just
hitting 2,000 words, let's say.
That's good.
That's your goal.
Yeah.
But
and then just,
then what's the other kind of overlays besides just the volume?
Having like a breakthrough. So thinking, oh yeah, I can feel what's happening with this character now. I like this character. Because I think, you know, characters, are, you know, the story is good, but I think what people really remember about novels is characters. Well, I certainly do. And when I feel like a character's come to life for me, then, you know, that's, you know, that's a big, big bonus, I think.
Well, in a great character can become a historical figure. I mean, you look at Sherlock Holmes.
Yes.
Or you look at, I mean, the list goes on and on.
Yeah.
But that's what I was having this little spat on Reddit where somebody said, Sherlock Holmes is a fictional, I was saying, mixing fictional, and this was a previous guest I had on the podcast, mixing fictional and historic figures, and somebody had said, Sherlock Holmes is a fictional character. And I said, yeah, but he's also a historic figure.
Yeah.
I mean, he's as real, you know, a lot of people don't even know that he's fictional because he's that real.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a beautiful thing when a writer is able to create a character that is that enduring and that real and that original.
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, that's what we all strive for, obviously, but
absolutely.
It's very hard to do.
Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. Yeah. I love it. I mean, Sherlock Holmes has stood the test of time, hasn't he? Like you say. I mean, yeah, I loved reading Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's stories about him and Watson. When I was a teenager, that was that's probably another big influence, actually. But
that's a good example right there. Now everybody knows Sherlock Holmes, but if you say to people who wrote Sherlock Holmes novels, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle is not going to come easily to the lips of most people, unless they were readers of those Sherlock Holmes novels. Yeah. But everybody knows of him, whether you've read his novels or not, which is again why I say he's truly a historic figure.
Yeah.
And people, we're still making movies about. And shows about Sherlock Holmes.
That's right.
Let me ask you about the balance between, and I don't know if you put much thought into this. I don't know if it varies from novel to novel, but expository writing versus dialogue.
Yeah.
And by expository writing, I sometimes wonder if I'm using this properly, but the idea being that the author is telling the story versus here's the characters speaking to one another. Mm. I say that for the listeners, just to clarify it for listeners. What are your thoughts on that? And what is your writing style? Do you have characters doing a lot of the storytelling or is it heavy on expository writing and then you sprinkle it with dialogue?
Mm-hmm. The Dojang is quite dialogue heavy. I mean, I think I've only got one review on the Dojang on Amazon, but one of them is one of them sort of mentions that in parts it feels like a film script because there's so much dialogue, but I think the dialogue kind of drives it in a way, drives the story along for me in a way, which is slightly more interesting for that, it just felt like the right thing to do for the Dojang, whereas for I Must Stay at Home there's very little dialogue simply because it's just a young guy on his own with his own thoughts. So So I guess it kind of partly depends on the story. And also, I kind of find if there's not enough dialogue, you can get bogged down unless it's a particularly good writer who's a novelist who's driving the story along. And then in dialogue, you can bring out, flesh out characters with dialogue, can't you, as well, the way they speak or, you know, their mannerisms, as they're speaking and stuff.
Yeah, you can do that. I do tend to think dialogue's overused overall, but and then I was going to mention Frederick Forsyth, his novels are almost entirely expository. There's very little in the way of dialogue. He really just is focused on telling the story. It's amazing how he's able to do so much of that without really bringing, he's got characters, but he's speaking for the characters.
Yeah.
And
actually, yeah.
But then there's some famous dialoguists, like, for instance, Elmore Leonard. It was always, people always said his dialogue is just outstanding.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, no, Elmore Leonard, that's probably another influence on me, actually. But his dialogue's very good. I think some people maybe struggle with dialogue as well, so they kind of shy away from it. But, I know what you mean by Frederick Forsyth. Actually, The Day of the Jackals, one of my favorite thrillers, actually.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
A classic.
Brilliant novel.
And there's another, crime. Well, his stuff also was crime oriented, although it was espionage. It was at a international
and
nations level most of the time.
Yeah.
So, you know how difficult writing is, and when you have a full time job, you're squeezing it in. You've got this new writing regimen or this new commitment to, I don't know how new it is, but to 2,000 words a day. Why do you choose to write at all? Because there's a lot of people who I think there's a tremendous number of people who think they have a book in them and they want to write it. They sit down and within a matter of hours, they're done. It's just, I don't mean done with the book. I mean, they just say, I can't do this. It's just, you think you can do it. And they just throw in the towel. Why do you choose to write knowing that it is oftentimes an exercise in frustration or repetition?
Yes. Yeah, that's a really good question. Yeah, I think partly because I just want to get the stories out. So it almost sounds almost a bit very nebulous. It doesn't sort of make sense, but it's kind of you have this, like you say, a lot of people think they have a novel in them. So, I just wanted to put the stories down on paper, and it's almost become like a hobby for me now. So I don't watch much TV, for example, anymore. I go after I've worked or after we've had dinner or something, I'll sit down and try to tap out a few more words that I didn't manage to do in the morning or whatever, or at lunchtime. And it's almost become a hobby. And I actually enjoy the process. So I enjoy the struggle.
I do too.
The struggle's part of the fun. So it's almost like, if you love music and you're trying to learn the guitar or a new song on the piano or another instrument, it can be a real struggle at first, but you know, you'll get that chemical release in your brain when you finally, whatever it is, when you finally achieve, you know, whatever piece of music you're trying to learn, it can be a high. And
yeah, you get the magic. Like high, there's the struggle, and then there's the magic where it just all of a sudden it starts to work out.
Yeah.
Something that you've been running up against a brick wall, and then it's this breakthrough.
Yeah.
And which you were talking about, that a good day of writing includes that breakthrough. Mm. And that's part of that, you know, the endorphin high that you really kind of get. I don't know if it's actually the endorphins. I'm not a biologist, but that high is definitely
there. I can't remember what it is. Yeah. I think, I don't know if it's the same thing as you get from exercise, but you get something from exercise, don't you? Is that
exactly that definitely is endorphins. Right, and I'm not sure if writing is the same thing, but unless you're running while you write and you're speaking into your recorder.
I guess it's just the struggle and the reward and I've got rewards for it. You know, people have, you know, friends and other people have said, I really enjoyed reading your book. And that's great. You know, I get great satisfaction from that. And just producing something, I think we all, everyone, you know, I'm a firm believer that everybody has a talent in something and everybody can produce something, whether it's, you know, carving a beautiful table, piece of furniture, or like I said, music or writing or whatever, or comedy or whatever. Everyone's got a talent, I feel, and it's hopefully
you bring some of those talents to your characters.
Hopefully I'm talented. Hopefully I've got have some talent in writing, you know, a smidgen. Yes. and then that kind of hopefully I'm using it in the right way. But it's kind of like I said, it's become a hobby. So it's when you enjoy doing a hobby, you keep doing it.
That's a good way of putting it. The hobby, you know, you're a hobbyist with the writing. I mean, I would say you're probably more than a hobbyist, but that approach, that just that mental framework of it's a hobby, but it's a hobby you're committed to at the same time. It's not kind of like I pick it up once in a while, you know, a few times a year I put together a model airplane. No, it's not like that. It's much more committed, but the hobbyist approach, I think, takes some of the, it's a good mental framework. It takes some of the burden away from the idea that you're trying to professionalize it, even though ultimately that would be a wonderful result. Mm-hmm. Do you outline your novels, or do you start with a premise and characters and see where that takes you?
Pretty much the latter. So yeah, I start with an idea or a character and I just see where it goes. I know that, I mean, we sort of mentioned James Elroy earlier, and I'm pretty sure that he's very meticulous in his planning. And then he kind of, then he sits down with his plan and fleshes it all out. But I think that's, I'm not sure if there's that much difference between doing it that way or the other way. So actually another one we mentioned, Lee Child. So Lee Child is from the Stephen King school of thought on this. Cause I don't know if you've read Stephen King's book on writing.
I have.
But he sort of talks about digging up stories are in the ground and he digs them out, or he kind of finds a gem and he cleans it up, or chips away at the statue and it all emerges. And he does that within the process of writing the story. The plot just emerges. And I quite like that approach to it. It kind of it surprises you as well. And if it surprises you as the writer, if something happens and you think, oh, this guy suddenly produced a gun out of somewhere or something, I don't know, just a silly example, but it kind of, if it surprises you, then you can almost put that down on paper and then it will surprise the reader even more. Whereas I think if you're plotting it too heavily, it can be a little bit clunky maybe. But, you know, I think you know, there's obviously both ways work, because novelists use both methods, don't they? So, but yeah, I prefer not to plot it out. Yeah.
Now, do you find, for instance, I want to ask you about the tricks your mind might play on you, for example, because this is an example really that where my mind will play tricks on me, where I already am thinking about, you know, two or three projects that I want to do next, books that I want to do. So here I am writing the one. And if it turns into a slog along the way, I start thinking, you know, I don't really have the momentum with this one. I should drop this one. I should do the other one. Yeah. So basically it's got going back to the starting blocks.
Yeah.
And I have to fight that don't get inspired by the things you're not working on. Just keep stick to your knitting and get this one completed.
Yeah.
Do you have other projects, books that you already know you want to write that are sitting out there?
Yeah.
Does it ever have that effect on you, or what other tricks does your mind play?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm totally in the same boat as you, Mike. So I have like four or five projects already in my head that I want to do down the line. I've actually just finished one novella about a guy who's got an old man who's got dementia. I've been writing it at the same time as a new project that I've been doing, which is, which I think I told you about a while ago, but I never got around to starting it, which is about a private detective based in London who's, again, the Polish connection, but he can trace his family history back to the last king of Poland. And he's basically an aristocrat, and he's set up an agency, that looks for, well, he's just a one-man band private detective. He looks for missing items or missing persons. Anyway, so I've been working on that at the same time as the novella, which I've just finished. And plus, I keep writing down notes about other projects. So I'm probably going to try and combine Prez from Redemption with Piotr from the Dojang in a future novel where they both work together as vigilantes. It does interfere a bit with the project that you're working on at hand. But I think the way I write my novellas is a little bit different to my novels. I can't quite put my finger on it right now, but they seem to come a lot easier to me. Probably just because it's a shorter story. There's not as many characters and not as intricate, but not as difficult to piece together. But it's I think it's really difficult to stick to one project, particularly if you're kind of struggling with it, like you say, if you've hit a dead end, or you're sort of thinking, is this really working, and you've got this great idea and you think, oh, I'll just start on this, and that's probably quite dangerous in some ways, but because you could just end up, you know, that could just spiral, couldn't it? You can end up doing the same thing project after project, book after book, novel after novel, thinking it's not going anywhere, I'll start on the next one, and then suddenly you've got six half finished novels.
So you have to, your mind is going to create resistance, and you have to battle against that.
But I think you have to get to the end. Exactly. That's what Stephen King says, actually. You have to get to the end, because once you've got to the end, then that's, you know, you can start really working on it. But anyway.
And it will haunt you if you don't get to the end. You know, you've got to get there, or it will haunt you in your dreams and your nightmares. You mentioned, you know, Stephen King, you read his book on writing, and you probably read other books about the writing process. So is there a piece of advice that you picked up along the way that you consider the best piece of writing advice, at least for you?
Yeah, I think it would be the one I just mentioned, actually. Just get to the end, because if you get to the end, that's a great achievement in itself.
What if you start at the end? I mean, there is, you know, John Irving.
Yeah.
You know, John Irving, right. He says that he starts with his final sentence of his book.
Right.
And then he writes to that sentence, right. I wonder if he's really telling the truth, because I find that to be really, I don't know. It just is such a meager scrap to be working with.
Mm.
But there are people who say write the ending first, especially if you're going to have a crescendo ending, write the ending first and then go to the beginning. Mm. And you know where it's almost like having your compass set before you go back to, start at
find that a bit frustrating, because I'd feel like I'm kind of constrained by, I have to get to this ending kind of thing. But I can see how that would work, actually. Yeah, but I've not heard of that what John Irving said before. But
it's an interesting strategy. Yeah. But one again, I wouldn't even attempt it, because I just think in terms of that, again, it's such a small scrap that the idea that you're going to get 80,000 or 90,000 words assembled in a way that. I just don't buy it.
Yeah.
If it works for him, that's great.
Yeah.
Because he's fabulously successful. Yeah. I love his books.
Yeah.
But, just not something I would attempt.
Yeah. 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 I suppose if you take the John Irving method, then I suppose get to the beginning, reverse it. but I think you just have to finish something, just get a first manuscript done. I think that's the most important thing. Because
that's
the first manuscript.
That's almost like training.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah. Because then you kind of you've got the first manuscript done, and if you've got it done, then that means there's something in there that's kind of working. Because otherwise, you would have abandoned it a long time ago, and there could be a hidden gem in there. So, yeah, and then you can play around with it. But I think that's the most important thing, is just to keep plowing on and get the first manuscript done of whatever you're working on. Yeah.
You know, there's times when I read, I'm very picky about the novels I read, and it's very often I'll be reading something and I'll think, this has gotten it's just words moving along, but it's boring. Didn't the author know that this is just kind of a boring scene or a boring collection of dialogue?
Yeah.
So with that in mind, of course, I always think in terms of, I don't want to bore the reader. Mm. Do you think in terms of I'm sure you do, but what is your view on, how do you know when you're writing something and you're thinking from the reader's point of view, which we always have to keep the reader's point of view in mind, really, when you've reached a point where it's like, this is where I might lose the reader. I'm going to rethink this whole thing, or I'm just going to trash it. I mean, what's that thought process for you while you're writing?
Yeah, I think, I guess that goes back to one of my reasons for writing, which is, which I maybe hadn't mentioned it, but it's kind of just because it's a story I wanted to get out there. So it's something that I don't think I'd seen before, or read before. So I kind of think of myself as a reader at the same time as being as a writer, which I guess is a kind of bit of a weird combo to have. But I'm kind of writing for myself. So in a way, I'm my reader. So I'm trying to please myself. So hopefully I have quite a good, BS detector. I'm maybe I don't. I mean, people can judge themselves. But I think I know when I'm getting boring. So if I'm boring myself, then I'm figuring someone else will be pretty bored with this.
I definitely have had that experience where I'm writing. I'm thinking, I'm bored with this. I'm bored with it.
Yeah.
So it's just like, just throw this out and rethink the whole, whether it's a chapter or a scene or whatever.
I mean, that's a really good skill to have. That kind of intuition to know when something's just a bit boring. I guess it kind of helps the more you read as well. I mean, that would be another piece of advice, would be just to read as much as you can, because that's where you kind of get your the tools, the things that work, the things that don't work. You kind of know them. They're almost you kind of had an innate knowledge of them simply because of the books you've read in the past, even books you can't remember or stories you can't remember.
You're in your subconscious mind.
Yeah, I think so.
You know, that architecture and the ideas. Yeah, I was just talking about this on the last podcast I did with Roy Peter Clark about how aspiring writers are told, if you want to be a writer, write. Mm. Just get out there and write, which is absolutely correct. Because one of probably the number one issue is that people, they want to write and they just don't do it. But you also need to read broadly it's almost like trying to tell somebody, go to work without a blueprint. And I don't mean an outline. I just mean that you understand what is possible with writing. You've read what other people do. You understand the strategies, the techniques, the characterizations and all of that. So now I have an understanding. You've learned the language on a deeper level and the practice on a deeper level. Now you're able to sit. And when you go for that daily output, you've got kind of that toolbox that Stephen King talks about. Mm-hmm. You need that toolbox to produce the work.
Yeah.
To get the projects done.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. I can't fault anything you said there, Mike, but I think, it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. I don't know if that's the right phrase to use. Like if you want to write, it's usually, if you want to be a writer, it's usually because you've read a lot as a kid or, as an adult.
Something inspired you.
Yeah. So it's
So
you've already kind of got the, some of the tools are ready to do it. You just have to work out how to use them. And I guess that's part, people talk about an apprenticeship and your first couple of manuscripts and stuff that aren't that good. But I think it's so true. You have to read as much as you can. Particularly if you're in a particular genre, like, crime or romance or fantasy or whatever, you have to know the tricks. You have to know this kind of storylines or the tricks that readers like, the arcs of the story, the character development.
On the other hand, we talk about, you have to keep the reader in mind. We agree on that. But there are writers who just say that if you're thinking about the audience, that's wrong. Don't think about the audience. Mm. Write what is what's inside you. Mm. What is that inner voice saying, regardless of what anybody else out there, regardless of the audience calculation, write what is in your heart, write what comes naturally to you, and then put it out there. If we run up the flagpole, some people hopefully will salute, hopefully millions of people will salute. But if you're chasing an audience, you've got the wrong approach. I think there's something to that too.
Yes.
But, I think it has an awful lot to do with the individual and what really, works for them.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's partly also to do with people who have the reader in mind so much so that they're trying to replicate, a previous novel. They're trying to write the next great thriller and they're kind of copying elements of the Da Vinci Code, or they're just trying to replicate some of those elements of those novels because they think they hit the right notes. But it's not authentic, is it? It's not real. So I think that's where that's coming from. You can still have the reader in mind as yourself as the reader, but it has to be, you can't be trying to please somebody because it just won't be authentic, I don't think. So it just won't work.
Right. Yeah. So Merrick, we're coming up on the hour here. So I wanted to ask you though, when is your next one going to be completed and published? Do you know yet?
Yeah. So
like what your time frame is?
So my new novella which is called Through Open Doors. That's I've done one edit and it doesn't need too much else doing to it. Some more proofreading. I do all my proofreading and editing myself. I don't pay anybody to do it. So that should be out hopefully in February sometime. And then my detective novel, I'm at about 35,000 words, so I'm hoping to have that finished. If I hit my 2,000 words target, I'll be finished by the end of February. I'm hoping to have that out in the spring or early summer. We'll see. We'll see how things go. But
you want to be more prolific, and yes, you are definitely achieving that, I have to say.
Trying to.
I know the effort. I know the struggle. But by day and by night, the day job and the night and the nighttime writing or early morning writing,
yeah,
Derek.
Yeah.
So I share your pain and your exhilaration. Thanks for coming on the program, and best of luck with your upcoming pieces of work.
Oh, thanks so much, Mike, and thanks for having me on. It's been really, really great to talk about things. So thank you.